We have until now been dealing with some of the motive forces in the background. We shall now begin to look at the period of the War of Independence and some of the problems that helped create the conflict. One of the basic problems that was a recurring factor in the background of the War of Independence was that theory of economics known as mercantilism. Mercantilism. Now, we cannot say that this was the cause of the war, but if it had not been for mercantilism, the problem would never have arisen. Mercantilism was a theory in terms of which France, Russia, Austria, Spain, and Britain, all the great powers of the day, operated. Now, mercantilism is important for us to understand because what we have today in our modern welfare economics, in our modern socialism, is a kind of a neo-mercantilism. Now, according to mercantilism, the most important thing for a country was to sell to other countries, but not buy from them. As a result, a mercantilist country would try to ship as much of its goods abroad, and accumulate gold from these sales because the currency of the day was gold. And at the same time, to close its borders as far as possible to foreign goods. There was nothing more horrible than buying, if you were an Englishman, something that was French. The standard of the day was buy French or buy Dutch or by British, whichever country you belong. Nothing from any of these other countries. Well, now, this creates a problem, does it not? Because how can you get the French to buy from you if you refuse to buy from them? And if they feel that their people should buy from no one, and yet you should buy from them. In other words, everybody under mercantilism, as under our contemporary ideas of tariffs, wants the rest of the world to buy their goods, but oh, what a sin if you buy theirs. Such as today it is held that the more we can sell abroad, the better. And we have a steady stream of salesmen flying out of Los Angeles and San Francisco to Japan. In fact, there's a regular business in the West Coast in Japan and dealing with these salesmen. One of the businesses is printing cards for them. You may have seen advertisements of this. So that when you schedule a flight and you're going to land in Japan, you have your business card printed for you in Japanese and English so that you're ready to start calling. They'll provide you with an interpreter and so on. But oh, what a fearful thing if the Japanese sell to us and anybody starts buying Japanese. This is neo-mercantilism in our midst. Now, what does this lead to? Well, if the French, the Germans, the Dutch, and all the other European countries refused to buy from one another and they wanted only to sell, the only place they could sell to was to a colony. The result was colonialism, a tremendous drive to establish colonies. The result was, in the 18th century in particular, every power of any continent was racing to establish colonies in different parts of the world. The whole point of the colony was to develop a market, somebody to sell to, so that they could get rich by having a built-in market and to say to this market, the colony, you can buy from no one else. You've got to buy only from us. This, of course, meant that from the very beginning there were prohibitions on the colony by the crown, because they were governed not by Parliament, but by the English crown. They had no relation to Parliament. They had gone out to start another country, a colony, under the King of England. They were not under Parliament. We'll come to that at a later date, perhaps tomorrow. Now, the immediate result was that these colonies were forbidden to buy from France. Or, it was regarded as a sin on the part of the American, the Yankee merchantmen to go around all the way to China or to India and to buy directly. They should buy only from British merchantmen, and only British ships to carry goods here, because the whole function of the colony was to act as a market to enrich the mother country. Well, of course, this means that the colony is there to be a pigeon, as it were, to sell and not to manufacture. There are all kinds of laws trying to inhibit manufacturing in the colony. Their only function was to provide the raw goods. And so, if cotton were produced, for example, in the southern colonies, it had to go to England and then come back from England in the form of clothing. The idea of any American trying to manufacture something was regarded as a serious offense. Hence, too, there were laws against dealing with the Indies or anywhere else. And so many of the founding fathers, especially from New England, were smugglers, because they believed such laws were immoral. They could not see any justice to them. Thus, mercantilism was protectionism of a very extreme sort, whereby the colony was not to develop, but only to be there as a source of raw materials and as a market. Now, it is significant that Canada never joined in on the American War of Independence. Canada had not developed to the point where it had any spark of independence. But where there was any desire to grow, where there was also the kind of theological background that the colonies had, it immediately meant that there was some rebellion and resentment against this situation. Why can't we develop our industry? Why can't our ships go where they want to? Why can't French ships come into here? Because we think for some things the French do better. As a result, neo-mercantilism created a problem. A serious problem. But this is not all. Neo-mercantilism created war. In what sense? Well, your economy after a while stagnates unless you have new markets. And the only way to get new markets is to go out and conquer them. The 18th century was a long series of wars because one country after another was trying to capture the colonies of the other country. These wars culminated finally in the loss of France's colonial empire. The two great sections in particular, and we cannot understand American history apart from this. First, Canada, an important source of raw materials and a market, was lost by France to Britain. Then second, India, a highly populated area, a tremendous market for goods, as well as the source of raw materials, was also lost by France to Britain. Now, this double loss was a tremendous paralysis to France. France was therefore tremendously anxious to see America, when the War of Independence broke out, triumph as a step towards doing in Britain which had done them in. Remember, the series of wars culminated in the French and Indian War. The French and Indian War was the war which preceded the War of Independence. Now, this loss of Canada and of India to Britain meant that the French government faced disaster. Under mercantilism, now their economy was in serious trouble. They were producing and they had no market. Their goods had no way of going beyond their borders. And France was faced with a collapse because it could not do Britain in. And so France, for this reason, was the great ally of the United States when the War of Independence broke out. It was the first step towards trying to reestablish itself by overthrowing the British power. And, of course, America was to be a market because America was ready to trade with the French or the British or anyone who had the goods. Now, of course, to finish out this story, it was too late. The economic disturbances in France because of the loss of India and of Canada were so great that its remaining great area, Louisiana Territory, was not developing fast enough to provide an adequate market, and France collapsed. The revolution was the result. The revolution would never have resulted if it had not been for the loss of its colony. The people would have been able to continue in their previous prosperity. But now you had a nation of malcontents. People who, because of mercantilism, were doomed to economic stagnation. Now, it was not, as long as the French Revolution was confined within France, that there was any trouble and any fear on the part of Britain. But when did the nations gang up on France? It was when Napoleon came to power, and Napoleon had this dream of reestablishing some kind of trade. Remember his Egyptian campaign, his campaign in the Middle East. Why? As a step towards recapturing India. And as a result, Great Britain engaged in unceasing warfare against France, against Napoleon. In order to overthrow Napoleon and prevent any kind of return of the French economy and the French colonial empire. Now, at a critical point when Napoleon was fearful of the future, he took an important step. We're looking ahead in American history now. What was that important step with regard to the Americans? Yes, he sold Louisiana to the United States. He knew that if he held on to it, the French being blockaded by Britain, the next step by Britain would be to go out and seize the Louisiana Territory. And so, he immediately took steps to sell it to the United States. Now, the United States throughout the Napoleonic War was very, very favorable to France. In fact, there was a great deal of trouble because of this, and we were involved finally in the War of 1812 against Britain. Not actually as an ally of France, but that was the practical effect of it. But Napoleon, by giving us, and it was really a gift, of the Louisiana Territory prevented Britain from getting that area and thereby blocking the western development of the United States. Now, there are two great events that gave America the West. Does anyone know the first? It has a lot to do with this state. One of the greatest men of American history was responsible for it. A very great Christian, man of tremendous reform faith. Does anyone who know who that Virginian was? Presley, the traveling evangelist. One of the greatest authors of American history. Does that give you a clue? Mason was a great Christian, but it was not Mason. Oh, Madison, no, it was not Madison. Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry, as governor of Virginia, when he saw the war was going to end, knew that there would be nothing more disastrous than a peace treaty which left the United States as a thin line along the Atlantic coast. And so he gathered together Virginians into an army and sent them out to the west to defeat the British there, to clean them out over the mountains, because he knew it would be nothing but disaster, and the United States would be doomed forever to be a small Atlantic seaboard country. Now, Patrick Henry thereby ensured a westward expansion of the United States. Then the next great step came with Napoleon's gift. These two things together ensure the westward expansion of the United States. Apart from these two things, this country would not be what it is today. Now, throughout the War of Independence, of course, the French were heavily involved on the American side. It was the French Navy at a critical point that came to our aid and delivered us. French troops were important in one battle after another. French money was basic. All these things because France was not so much pro-American, but anti-British, trying to overthrow the stranglehold Britain had gained upon them and to save their very existence. Did not work. They fell. But in the process, they helped create the United States. So, mercantilism is very important to an understanding of American history. Because without mercantilism, there would have been no problem in this country. It would have led to the discontent. They were Englishmen. They loved the mother country. They went over there regularly for their education, the upper class gentlemen. They had relatives there. They regarded themselves as Englishmen. But they were being treated as second-class Englishmen, as people who were there simply to be exploited. And this was because of the theory of mercantilism. Mercantilism produces war. It always has. And today when you have neo-mercantilism that closes borders, again, it leads to war. Now we're going a little astray from American history, but we're trying to understand the motive forces in history. So it's important to realize that today, when you have the kind of economy you do in the Soviet Union, a parasitic economy, the only way the Soviet economy can thrive is by imperialism. It has to have a new area discussed periodically. And unfortunately, all the economies of the world, because of their neo-mercantilism, have this same tendency. They have become parasitic. They want to sell but not to buy. And so they have to treat areas as virtually as colonies. So while in the name of anti-colonialism we have denied colonialism and we have forced the European powers to surrender their colonies, what are we doing? We are creating a neo-mercantilist empire so that the states of Africa, the countries of Africa, which are ersatz countries, exist in terms of subsidies from various governments. And these subsidies have one purpose, to ensure that they will buy from that country. When we give money to Ghana, as we have, what are we saying to Ghana? All right, Ghana, here are so many hundreds of millions of dollars, but you get this only as you buy American. So you're going to ask an American firm, Kaiser, to come in and build a huge dam for you, and you're going to buy American cars and American tractors. You're going to be on market. But at the same time, of course, the American taxpayer paying for it. But what if other countries are trying to get Ghana to be their colony, as it were? You see the trouble it leads to. And you have the CIA all over the world, and you have the Russian secret police all over the world, and you have the British and the French and all. Because of neo-mercantilism, they're all playing the colonial game when they're all denying the game, and they're saying we are anti-colonial. Mercantilism, which is a form of socialism, leads to war. Now consider one famous mercantilist event in American history, the Boston Tea Party. The Americans were smuggling in tea. They did not like the controlled British prices. So what did Britain do? The East India Company was near bankruptcy. They couldn't compete with the smugglers. After all, a subsidized industry cannot compete with a free enterprise industry. If you want a good example of that, look at the Fairfax Public School and look at the Christian schools such as Fairfax Christian School. They are subsidized businesses competing with a free enterprise school. And they don't do well in the competition. They cannot produce for the same price the same product. So what happened at the Boston Tea Party? They decided, the British Parliament did, let us subsidize the tea price. Let us make it so low that it will be impossible for these Americans to compete with us. In other words, we will lower the price of tea so that if any American tries to bring it in, it's at a loss. And we'll wipe out these American businessmen who are competing with us. What was the reaction of the Americans? Well, at one harbor after another, they raided the ships and dumped the tea into the harbor. This was a protest against mercantilism. And it is very interesting that while some of the new states did have mercantilist ideas, and those ideas were not immediately eliminated, the new ideas of Adam Smith with respect to free trade and a free enterprise economy became increasingly popular in the various colonies. Now, at the same time that mercantilism was operative, there was another factor. Money in those days was gold. Each of the colonies was an independent country with its own legislature, its own government, its own taxes, paying all its officials, and its connection with England was non-existent. England had a king who was the king of England, Scotland, and Ireland. He was also the king of New York and of Virginia and Massachusetts and so on. They all had the same king. He ruled each of these areas through their local self-government and through a royal governor, and he had a veto power. Now, Virginia had the right to issue coins. Massachusetts had the right to issue coins. Each of the colonies had that right. But most of the time when they tried to issue coinage, the king vetoed it. Why? He wanted their economy to be dependent upon the British economy. And if they got too independent, issuing their own coinage and building up their own businesses, then they would be independent of the English economy. So while Parliament had no authority over the colonies, we'll come to the attempt of Parliament to usurp authority with the cooperation of the king somewhat later. The king was trying to prevent these colonies from taking their logical development. And so it was that the idea was, well, if they have any silver or gold, they're to pay it to the English for the goods that are delivered. And in the early days, what was happening, for example, was that a boatload of settlers would arrive in America, and they would have some gold and silver since they came from the old country. And everybody would say, look, you're new here. Now, I'll work for you. I'll build your house, or I'll clear your land for you if you'll pay me the gold. So the next time a ship landed, that gold which they'd earned working for the new people would go to buy British goods, and it would go right back to England. There'd be no gold here or silver until another boatload of people arrived. And so the New England colony started it first. They said, we will give a tax moratorium of so many years for any New Englander who will build a ship and institute trade so that we can be free of this terrible situation. So there was a desire to gain independence by having their own currency and by developing their own economy. But the king vetoed virtually every measure. So what did the colonies do? Now, this was an act of reprisal. It had very dangerous tendencies. But nonetheless, it was done as a form of economic warfare with England. Since the King of England was acting as England's king rather than Virginia's or Massachusetts or New York, and favoring England rather than these colonies, by saying, I'm going to protect English business and give it rights that you don't have, rights in your own colony. They decided, all right, now take time to mint money. But you can print paper money in a day. So if we pass a measure saying that this issue of paper money is legal tender and must be accepted by everyone for all debts, then, by the time that act goes back to England, and the king vetoes it, which he will, and always did, and it comes back sometime in past. And until that veto comes back, it is legal, according to our charter. By the king's admission, everything is legal until he vetoes it. In that time, we can make these merchants from England take it. They have to take it. So as a form of economic warfare, they started issuing paper currency from the colonies. An English ship would land, a subsidized ship with all its wares, and the Americans would go down there and pay for it, pay for them. The merchants would say, we don't want this, these English merchants. I'd say, oh, but you have to take it. It's legal tender. The king has not vetoed it. And they had to. They'd go back and complain to the crown. And the crown would say, well, we vetoed it. Well, by the time they came back with the next vote, there was another paper money issue that had not yet been vetoed by the crown. Now, this was economic warfare as a product of mercantilism. And this warfare built up until a few years before the War of Independence, the British crown across the board forbade, because so many English merchants were complaining, all further issues of paper money. Now, this again was a very important fact in leading to the War of Independence, because they had been penalized. Now, of course, it did create some bad side effects, because since it was payable for all debts, public and private, some of the ne'er-do-wells in the colonies would, of course, take the money and pay off anyone in the colonies that owed them money. They had borrowed money from their neighbor, they'd take this paper money and pay them off and say, well, the House of Burgesses has voted it through, you have to accept it. So there were some side effects in the United States, or rather in the colonies, that were not altogether good. But it did create an appetite for paper money, which subsequently arose to plague the young United States under the Articles of Confederation. And this is why in the Constitution, only gold and silver are specified as legal tender because the debtors wanted the cheap money so that they could go into debt and pay off with worthless papers. Now, the man who is responsible for that hard money cost of the Constitution, which is still there, although we pay no attention to it, was, does anyone know his name? John Witherspoon, yes. John Witherspoon, one of the great lights of the Presbyterian Church, president of Princeton, then known as the College of New Jersey, and a Calvinist. A very godly man. And John Witherspoon wrote an essay on money to propagate the hard money doctrine, and in the Continental Congress spoke eloquently time and again against a paper currency. Now, I'm going to stop at this point to see if there are any questions before we proceed any further. We've been dealing with some very important economic issues. Yes, John.
What can be done, if anything, against the U.S. policy?
Now, of course, the question, if you heard it, was an economics question. If the United States had free trade, but the Japanese did not, what should we do against the United States? Well, of course, we shouldn't do anything. The advantage of free trade is it wipes out businesses that are not profitable, that are protected. But what it does do is to bring in cheap goods. Free trade favors the consumer always because it makes available to you food and goods that are cheaply produced. Now, you see, the United States is, by the Constitution, a free trade area. There can be no tariffs between states. Now, what has this done? Well, it has given us more and cheaper food. One of the things that has happened in the past generation is that a lot of land in the east and in the south that was farmland has gone back to woodland. Why? Well, California is the reason. California today is producing so much food so cheaply that it's far cheaper to ship it from California to the east than to produce it in the east. This is why animals in some states like New York that were believed to be extinct are being found again. They reappeared as areas have gone back into woodland. Now, has this hurt New York? No, it is not. It has meant simply that that which can be produced most cheaply in the United States in the way of food is produced where it can be done most effectively. Well, today, now, to continue this analogy, today we do have, in a sense, a tariff in the United States. A dishonest tariff. Earlier, we had it in the form of dishonest railroad freight rates, which discriminated against the South. But today, there is a very important law on the books, which is designed to prevent free trade within the United States and to protect a certain area. Can you guess what that law is? Yes. Minimum wage law, yes, the minimum wage law. Now, why is the minimum wage law a discriminatory law? Well, it discriminates against the South and the West. You see, if you did not have a minimum wage law, what would happen? The South could produce a lot of things far more cheaply than the North Atlantic states. And it was the North Atlantic states, the eastern states, that were responsible for the minimum wage law. To knock out the competition of the West and especially of the southern states. So, what has the result been? Higher prices. Because what the South could once produce very cheaply, it could no longer produce as cheaply because it has to pay a high minimum wage.
Now consider another implication of the minimum wage law.
Because it has priced labor so highly, it has knocked out millions of people who otherwise would have gainful jobs from the labor market.
For example, one of the tragic forms of unemployment that it has created is Negro unemployment. It used to be possible for a young, unskilled Negro to get a job at very low wages and learn a kind of work, a trade. Neither he nor the unskilled white boy can do that today, because with a minimum wage law plus various state and federal benefits that have to be paid in, it amounts to about $2.50 an hour.
Well, who can afford to hire an untrained kid and spend a year or two training him for a job at wages like that? When you hire somebody who is unskilled in any kind of job, it takes a year or two for him to be worth anything to you because it takes you that long to educate him.
You know, if you go to work for the telephone company as an operator, they spend about 6 weeks training you, but you have to work 2 years before they make anything out of that training they've given to you. So if you quit in less than 2 years' time, they've lost their investment in you.
Well, with someone who's totally unskilled, even if they pay them only 50 cents an hour for the first year or so, they're not making money because they're investing time and equipment in training them. The minimum wage law has made it impossible for that to be done.
The textile mills that were booming all over the South, one after another, shut down. What the North Atlantic states have done is to eliminate from competition manufacturing in the South and in the West. Now, labor was cheaper in the South than in the West, one thing, because you didn't have the high cost of living that you have in metropolitan centers like Philadelphia and Boston, Chicago, and New York especially. Therefore, you could live more cheaply. Moreover, the weather being milder in the South than in the West, you don't have the same cost of living. Now consider the difference in the cost of living if you are on mild weather. Your fuel bill alone, your clothing. You can take less money and live better. I know one man who moved from California to New York at $10,000 a year increase in salary and was the fittest man in the world after he got there because he found he was taking a big cut in salary as far as purchasing power was concerned. So, you see, what free trade has done in the United States in the area of food has been to provide you with more food more cheaply. But by destroying free trade in the United States in the area of manufacturing through the minimum wage law, what has happened is that we have upped the price of goods. We have discriminated against the South and the West in favor of the North Atlantic states. Now, consider what will happen if one of these days we suddenly abandon the minimum wage law. Incidentally, anyone who is unemployed to the age of 25 is thereafter unemployable. It's a sad fact that they are. They're no longer fit to work if they've been on welfare at that point. They lack the discipline of work in those early years and are unemployable. Attempts through the job clause, take these people and try to train them have been virtually useless. Maybe 1 out of 100 will turn out to be fit for work. Well, on an international scale, free trade does wipe out some people, but it actually booms an area. We've never had truly free trade, but whenever to any extent we have cut the tariffs, we have actually raised the standard of living in this country, raised the productivity tremendously. Does that help answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, to give you an example, a few years ago, the price of wheat collapsed. Why? Because we passed some restrictions against Japanese textiles, yardage. What does that mean? Well, since the Japanese could not sell to us, they could no longer buy from us. And that hurt the wheat growers, it hurt the orange growers. Because every time the Japanese sold to us, they had money to buy from us. And our best customer in the world, by a huge margin today, is the Japanese. If you took away the Japanese trade, business would fold. They are our best customers by a tremendous margin. Any other questions? Well, I think tonight we will adjourn a little early. It's been a long day. But tomorrow night we will continue with our study of the basic motives and ideas as they have operated in American history.